Hey guys, and welcome to the Pacing and Racing Podcast, the Canadian triathlon podcast made in mind for the age group triathletes. So today we welcome Coach Joel Filio on the podcast, who most of you may already know, but if you don't, he's recognized as one of the most successful triathlon coaches in the world. His umbrella of coaching stems across so many levels, from the Olympics to Ironman to junior development, all the way up to the Senior World Championships. Joel has guided athletes to world-class successes at so many levels. So Joel has worked with Ironman athletes like Helly Fredrickson, Olympic athletes like Mario Mola, Simon Whitfield, and Alistair Brownlee. He's currently working as the Olympic Performance Director for the Triathlon Federation of Italy to help prepare athletes for Tokyo 2020. And he also has what he calls the JFT crew, consisting of world-class triathletes focusing on the ITU series, including some recent podcast guests and the 2019 world champions like Katie Zafirez and Vincent Luiz. So Joel's training and knowledge extends so far into the roots of triathlon, and I'm excited and honored to have him on the podcast as we talk about topics like Tokyo 2020, his outlook on Kona this year, the JFT crew, and key takeaways for age group triathletes. So this is a podcast jam-packed with valuable knowledge and wisdom about endurance training specific to age groupers. So relax, take notes, and enjoy the episode. Now let's cue the music. First sponsor of today's show is Soul Fitness Canada, who is a premier global name in the fitness industry and has become one of the fastest growing fitness brands across the US and Canada. And the reason why I'm so excited for Soul Fitness Canada to be the show sponsor is because all of you know we are unfortunately nearing the end of summer, which means as a proactive thinker, I have to start thinking about indoor training. And with Challenge Roth just under 11 months away, we're ramping up the volume and running, which requires a treadmill that I'll be able to spend countless hours on. So with lots of research, I found a brand that I can stand behind for their value, quality, and their service. And I'm excited to say that I ended up actually getting the TT8 treadmill from Soul Fitness Canada. And so you'll definitely be seeing lots of this treadmill, guys, in the pacing racing videos. And I can't wait to put some miles on inside the paint cave. And now you may ask, how did I end up choosing Soul Fitness Canada over all the other brands? So for those who don't know, Soul has a full line of treadmills, ellipticals, and exercise bikes, and has been in the industry for decades and is a popular brand well over 29 countries. They are one of the only manufacturers to warehouse all their parts and products in Canada and host a fully bilingual customer service team. And to briefly touch on the treadmill I went with, it offers up to 15 levels of incline, 6 levels of decline with speeds up to 12 miles per hour. It has accurate heart rate monitoring with both pulse grips and chest strap options, and the TT8 features a large 22-inch by 60-inch running surface, inboard speakers, and a cooling fan, and so much more, guys. So these are all important factors for me when I went looking for a treadmill. And another thing that may resonate with the listeners is it's not just for winter training. In fact, I have a daughter that's 19 months old and who happens to love her nap time. So I love the idea that I'm able to go for a long run on the treadmill while she sleeps. And I think this is a great way for effective time management for the time crunch triathletes out there. So if any of you are in the market for treadmills, bikes, rowers, or ellipticals, or any of that stuff for your pain cave, then head to soulfitness.ca/pacing-and-racing. And again, Soul is spelled S-O-L-E. And if you guys have any questions on products, then you definitely shoot me a DM and I can help guide you into a treadmill that would suit your needs. So Soul Fitness is providing Pacing Racing listeners a free equipment mat with any cardio equipment they purchase from the website, which is a $50 value. So that's super cool of them, guys. And all you have to do is type in Pacing and Racing during checkout. The second sponsor of today's podcast is Cycon Bags, which I'm super thrilled about because, of course, being here in Canada, unfortunately, it requires a ton of traveling and flying to get around to some of these big named races. So Cycon has actually offered up a 30% discount to the Pacing and Racing listeners, and you can reap benefits of this by using the promo code PACINGANDRACING at checkout for 30% off. So if anyone has actually traveled with a bike before, you may know that it's an extremely hectic journey if you aren't prepared. And not only that, but it's a whole process of taking your bike apart and putting it back together when you get there. Meanwhile, on this flight, you're praying that your bike doesn't get damaged. So, I mean, that's why I'm thrilled to say after a ton of research into this bike cases, they finally went with the Cycon Aerotech Evolution X, and I cannot wait to show you guys. So I'll be doing a video going over in detail exactly how easy it is to store my bike in it to travel, how little time it takes, and most importantly, how convenient it is to travel with. And so now many of my listeners who follow me know I'm a big fan of keeping costs low because we all know triathlon is just such an expensive sport. But I truly think a bike case is just one of those few items that you should definitely not cheap out on, guys. And the reason why I say this is because there'd be no worse feeling than traveling to a race only to get there with a damaged bike or even dealing with the stress of rebuilding your bike. So for a few quick points on the bike case that I chose, it's one of the toughest and lightest hard shell cases in the world, yet it only comes in at a very light 26 pounds. And it can fit bikes up to 62 centimeters in size and wheels up to 26 inches. And with smaller bikes like mine, they can actually fit without removing a saddle. And in most cases, you only need to actually remove the wheels, remove one pedal, and turn the handlebars. That's it. And of course, I could talk up the bike case I bought, but there's just so many more Cycon bags available that they all have their own neat perks and bonuses. So, I mean, definitely feel free to browse around, see which one best suits you and your needs. And if you want to check all these out, guys, you can check them out and see what's on sale by heading to www.cyconbags.com or search them on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube by typing in Cycon, which again is spelled S-C-I-C-O-N. So Joel, welcome to the Pace Racing Podcast, man. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me, Steven.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for coming on. And obviously happy to have you here. I know you're super busy, guys. So that means a lot that you came on to talk. So there's lots to go over today. But I mean, before we dive into everything, let's briefly catch up the listeners up just a bit about your background in the sport, because you've been competing and coaching for many, many years now and have coached amazing athletes across the ITU, the Olympics, Ironman, and so many more. So could you give us a little bit of a timeline, paint the picture here, I guess, for the listeners?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I started, I guess I am Canadian originally. I've been outside of Canada for about 10 years now, but I started doing triathlon in Kids of Steel in Ontario in 89 or 90 was my first triathlon. My father was a cyclist and that got me into some club triathlons and eventually moved up and up, and actually my first coach was Barry Shepley of Canadian Cross Training Club. I don't think it was called that then, I could be wrong, but I competed for Canada as a junior. I wasn't very high level, but I still grateful for the opportunity, because I probably wouldn't be sitting here now if I hadn't done that. And at the time, probably it was more participation focused than very elite focused at the junior level. So that was a good opportunity to get involved in the sport. And it kind of grew from there. I moved out to Victoria in 2001 to really start properly coaching. And that was just after Simon Whitfield had won a gold in Sydney, which the anniversary was a few days ago of that. And that was the start of actually really coaching, and it was, I suppose, it was a development role, and that just grew over time. As the years rolled by, I also got into more private stuff, and I've been really bouncing back between federation type work and private work, and now I'm combining both of those. But it grew into me taking on the head coach role in Victoria in 2005 and through to Beijing working with Simon where he won the silver medal in Beijing, his second Olympic medal. That's really briefly through Canada, and then I moved over to the UK, which where I live now. I took the head coach job for British Triathlon, and in the end, it wasn't quite the right fit. So I went back to private coaching, and that was really the start of what I've been doing since then. When I started the current iteration of the squad now in 2013, I guess late 2012, and now all the way to now. Now my main job is working for the Italian Federation. And you know, I spent a lot of time going back and forth to Italy and working with Italian athletes, but also I like to call it my side project to the JFT crew, which obviously is a bit more than a side project, but it has a really good synergy with the work I do with the Italian Federation, and that leads me to now.
Yeah, man. So that's amazing. It's an incredible story to hear that. And actually, so it's pretty cool actually that you mentioned Kids of Steel all those many years ago too, because that's still a prominent thing here in Ontario as well. And I have nieces and nephews who have raced in events like that with the Kids of Steel. So that's pretty cool to see that that's still kicking. And that's sort of where you started off back in the day. So that was amazing to hear. And of course, this being a Canadian triathlon podcast, I'm sure many of the listeners are very familiar with Simon Whitfield and everything he's done. So that was really cool that you played a big integral part along with him or aside with him. So that was really cool to hear. So what made you sort of go overseas to Italy for the Federation team? Is it just sort of bounce around? You just had a lot of athletes out in that area there or?
Well, I guess I can start with what made me move to Great Britain. And that was, I guess, the culmination of the project with Simon and the project with Triathlon Canada that went to Beijing and we had great success there. But often after great success, it's a time for change. And it certainly was for me personally. Needed a life change and a focus change. And that's what led me overseas the first time. And I think at the time there wasn't a lot of kind of international transfers of coaches, if you like. I mean, that's very common in other sports, and mm-hmm. Not so much in triathlon. So it was quite a learning experience. And eventually, you know, when in this role after the Rio Olympics, when this opportunity came up, I had a couple of different options, but having had worked totally privately since the London Olympic cycle. So those 4 years, I thought there's an opportunity to enhance what we're doing and also bring the experience that we have with all of these amazing Olympic focused athletes to bring that in a partnership with a federation. And I was fortunate there was someone in the Italian Federation that thought the same way. So several people, including the president and some other coaches that thought, you know, let's bring the best that we can to Italy and we'll make, you know, a partnership and give our athletes the best experience they can have and to train with some of the world's top athletes. And so that I think it was very forward thinking and it's not very common amongst, you know, kind of federation kind of programs. Although, you know, the impact of the private groups like we've had have had a big influence on how people think about what the best environments can be to develop athletes. So it was fortunate that there was the right opportunity that came along and, you know, and that continues now through to Tokyo.
Yeah, no, that's incredible, man. Well, I mean, just hearing some of the names you've worked with over the years, like it truly shows how well-respected you are in the sport. So it's really cool to see that. Like, So I guess, how do you decide on how many athletes you can oversee each year? Because I can imagine it takes a ton of time and focus on each athlete if they're competing at those top levels.
Yeah, I mean, actually, we've been fortunate that many of the athletes have been the same since the beginning that I work with in the squad. Some of them right since the very first camp. So it doesn't change all the time. So you know, I guess it's not a matter of necessarily deciding, but pretty much we've been full, if you like, for a few years now. So we only take new athletes in a real special circumstance where we think there's a great fit and where they can really match the energy that we want in the group. And so, you know, that can be somebody like Vincent Louis that joined last year. Who's been just fantastic on helping and supporting all the other athletes, as well as obviously having the chance to work with him personally, or Non Stanford, who had a little bit of overlap when I was doing the British job, but has really been a great addition to the group. And I guess what we're looking for is people that can see the benefit of giving and receiving, you know, giving back to other athletes, being good training partners. And where some of our success comes from is how we manage that daily environment. So the right athlete has to fit into that, in the sense of we don't want our training sessions to become like mini competitions, despite what you might imagine. You know, when we have some of the best athletes in the world training together, the goal is not for them to push each other necessarily faster. We don't want them to get into kind of racing each other. In fact, we need kind of great self-discipline to be able to be consistent over time. And that's where the support, they help each other get through that and help go through the process of every day, the grind, if you like, of endurance sport. So they have to have the right fit in that mentality. And not everybody does, and not everybody is ready for that. And one of the, I suppose, advantages that I've observed over time with this kind of environment is when an athlete chooses to be part of it, they make a conscious choice that I'm going to invest in myself and I'm going to join this project that sits probably outside their comfort zone, outside of what they're used to, because I think one of the challenges in federation programs in Canada and elsewhere is with the advent of government funding, you know, a lot of the athletes just kind of do the default to whatever the national program is or whatever they're told to do, if you like.
Right.
And they just don't have as much autonomy in that kind of environment. And often it can work really well. I mean, we had a fantastic vibe in Canada and Victoria for that Beijing cycle. It was a great group and a great environment. And that was a full federation supported program with Triathlon Canada. But not everyone is like that, and it's not going to fit for everyone. So I think where groups like ours fit sort of a niche that athletes are ready to move out of that, they're ready to make their own decisions and take probably more responsibility for their career. And often, again, that means investing in themselves, investing in other people also to be part of that journey along with them.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And it's really cool to see, because your JFT crew, the squad there, you have athletes from sort of all over the world. And now, do you guys train, do you guys have training camps per se? And they kind of go off back. So I guess with Vincent Louis being from France and Katie being from the States, are you guys always training together, or is there a little bit of long distance training implemented into the squad, or how does this sort of all work?
Yeah, our model is one, I suppose, in contrast with a residential program like Leeds or like Victoria, where athletes live and train in the same place. We meet and train in training camps, and we spend a lot of time throughout the year in training camps. So our typical model will start in December, and we'll spend about 3 weeks in a training camp, and then short break over Christmas, and then from the new year, it could be almost all the way till now, till we're in September. Now the grand final was a bit earlier this year, but really for those 9 months, we spend the majority of time in training camps, not always in the same place. We move around a fair bit, but we spend all that time in that environment together. And so it really has the advantage, I suppose, over a residential program is just that camp focus, where you're not at home, you're not around friends and family, you really have that full focus on, you know, eat, sleep, train, recover, and I find that an advantage. It's not easy for everyone, and it's not easy over the longer term. All of these athletes are, you know, senior elite athletes or adults. They're not juniors anymore. They I think they appreciate a little bit of life autonomy, but at the same time, that structure is not easy to maintain, but it has a lot of real advantages. And so we're more European based, I suppose. So athletes who are from the US like Katie, will spend a long time outside of the US every year. But the ITU circuit is, I guess, it's not exclusively focused on Europe. There are actually not that many events, but that's where our bases tend to be. So we spend a lot of time in Spain, either in the Canary Islands or Mallorca or outside of Barcelona, and also in France. So this year we did do a camp in the US in Flagstaff, but it depends. I guess the beauty of this is we can decide where we want to go every year based on the calendar, based on what we think the ideal schedule is. And we have sort of a flexibility about that. We're not tied to any particular place, so we can decide what makes sense. And although we tend to go back to the same places because the familiarity over time, saves energy, saves time. Everyone knows, you know, the routes, the places to go. So that does save energy. But at the same time, we're flexible to change according to what we need to do.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. I think it's a really cool experience for the athletes as well. You know, going to Spain, I know Spain's a big popular place. I know Vince and Louis had nothing but amazing things to say about training camps in Spain. So that's really cool to hear. I'm sure they get a lot out of that. I'm sure being ITU athletes, they're used to the travel, like you just said there. That's just one of the exceptions of ITU. There's lots of traveling all over the world every year. And so I guess looking at these days here, I can assume you guys are quite busy. You have your hands full with Tokyo 2020 just around the corner. So I think it's safe to say that most, if not all, your athletes are preparing for the Olympics, are they?
Yeah, I mean, either they're in a position where qualification isn't really the issue, or they're that's really, to be fair, most of the athletes that we're working with on the private side of the JFT cruise side, that they're, you know, either the best in their country or near. So I guess my philosophy on the Olympics is for a lot of athletes, it is the main focus and the big kind of career goal. But I feel it's also important to try to be successful, you know, every time they race. And I suppose it's the beauty of the World Series now in ITU is that all of the races are a certain level of importance. And in fact, the world titles are based on being consistent through the year. And so I find that's a good focus. I think as kind of well-rounded professional athletes, it's good to be able to be successful whenever you race and to enjoy that process. And, you know, next year we're going to think about, you know, how much focus do we put on Tokyo? And I suppose it's somewhat individual. It's not the same for everyone. And of course it's a big goal, and, you know, we'd love to set the athletes best up as they can be to have medal winning performances there. But it's not the only thing that's important. I think, again, we're fortunate in triathlon that there's multiple elements to that, to our sport, you know, from the different series. We have the Super Leagues coming up. We have athletes racing French Grand Prix. We have of course, the Olympic Games and the World Series. And, you know, maybe some of the athletes next year might be thinking about longer distance races as well. So there's quite a lot to it. And again, I wouldn't diminish the focus that we have on the Olympic Games. But I see that as one part of a bigger picture of how do we get the athletes to perform at their best consistently.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. So actually, you touched on a couple really great points there. So you mentioned some of the ITU athletes maybe or are currently pursuing the longer distance, but also you touched base on the Super League series as well. Now, I was curious to see how that sort of all fits in around, you know, with the ITU schedule already being so heavy with, like you said, the Cup Series and everything. So when it comes to the Super League, you have Katie Zafiris, Vincent Louis, just to name a couple of them, who have done really well, exceptionally well in the Super League Series. Now, is that something that you guys have incorporated into the training plan as well? Like, how does that fit in with your current ITU schedule?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long year. I mean, the guys started the Super League athletes, including Katie and Vince. They started all the way back in February in Singapore, and the ITU season started in the beginning of March in Abu Dhabi. So it makes for a long year, and the Super League is a great opportunity for the athletes from a kind of a different format, something that's motivational and very challenging, extremely challenging, and also an opportunity professionally for prize money and the coverage that the Super League, the effort they put into doing a fantastic coverage. It's not something that we have a particular focus on, but that fits our philosophy in general in that we want to be good whenever we race and to take those opportunities. So the success that the guys have had in the Super League hasn't come from a really big focus or specific preparation, but merely being, you know, healthy, ready to race and with deep fitness. And I think it's a principle that's important. We often think, you know, we have to be really specifically prepared for whatever events that we're doing. But in fact, there's kind of a general deep aerobic fitness sets you up for success across distances, you know, from, you know, 20-minute races that we see in the mixed relay to, you know, multiple of those short races in the Super League, you know, to Olympic distance. And I mean, you could even say, depending on the type of training that someone is doing, to 70.3 that we saw in Nice with Gustav Iden winning that race without any particular focus, you could say. So that general fitness serves the athletes well. And I suppose in particular, talking about the Super League, I think one of the factors is that the multiple races over the 2 days is probably more similar to an Olympic distance race in terms of stress and load than it is a super sprint race. Yeah, you know, you have to be able to recover, you have to be able to back it up, and being able to do that seems to come from as much just that strong fitness and ability to tolerate the pace changes and recover and repeat and repeat. And, you know, be able to be strong the second day is where you need to do if you want to win these kind of races. So I think it fits a general approach that we have in terms of how do we prepare.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It makes a ton of sense. And I guess from your perspective, from an innovative perspective, I guess, what were your thoughts on the Super League now that you've seen it kind of roll out now for a couple of years? Is that something you can see a lot of your athletes switching to over time? Or what's your take on the Super League in general?
Yeah, I mean, it's a revival of a concept from a number of years ago in Australia, which I suppose originated from the surf lifesaving or beach triathlons that they had. They had the St. George's series, and then it went through various iterations. This is in the late 90s and early 2000s, and I suppose the originator of the Super League now, or the guy with the idea is Chris McCormick Macca, and he raced back in the day in those races. So, I mean, they're great races. They're really tough. As I said, they're extremely difficult races, and they've really put a great model around them. You can see they have fantastic production, great television, commentating, interesting, tough circuit courses. They don't suit every athlete. And we make the decision whether they're going to race based on a number of factors. You know, and they need to be able to be reaching that point in the season healthy and with energy to race. And that's one of the things you see. If they're knackered from the season, then they're not going to be able to race well over that kind of distance and that kind of format. So they do need, you know, some individual approach according to the energy. But in general, I mean, it's super supportive of the concept. And it's great that our athletes have another opportunity to perform. From a professional point of view, they do a great job.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a great way of painting a perspective on it, because it's so true. And as you just mentioned there, yeah, like I guess it isn't really for everyone. And as you could kind of see, you see a lot of the Ironman athletes or Ironman 7.3 athletes who've tried to drop down to that level. And it's just, it's pretty incomparable when you see them up against the ITU guys. And I guess even, which is what I've been found really fascinating lately, is we're seeing more and more ITU athletes making headways in Ironmans these days with, you know, like you just mentioned earlier, guys like Gustav winning the 7.3 Worlds recently. And then also Christian Blumenfeld as well, who set that world record for the 7.3 distance. And even recently, Alistair Brown-Lee heading to Kona. I mean, what's your thoughts on all that? Is that something we might see more and more of, especially after the 2020 Olympics and all that dust has settled?
I mean, I guess every Olympic cycle we think about and talk about the same things. And I guess it's a matter of, I mean, it is quite individual, and it's a matter of incentives and in, you know, motivation. I mean, I think in theory, you know, when we have a course like in Nice for where we saw Gustav Iden win, I mean, it helps if there's a climbing heavy course that perhaps doesn't have as much specificity as far as flat time trial position and ability to put out watts in a very aerodynamic position, which some ITU athletes would be the limiting factor, is the amount of time that they could focus on adapting their body to that. Like any discipline, you know, that's one of the specific things you have to be able to do. And some people, they adapt more quickly, and some take more time. And, you know, one of the athletes that I was talking about recently in another interview was David McNamee, who went from ITU racing, it's been a few years now, but now has been in the Kona podium twice. You know, it's taken him some time to adapt his body to the cycling position, and particularly over the full distance. I think it is something that has to be respected, and it takes time, and not every athlete will be able to do that. I think over ITU athletes, obviously the you know, when you reference Ironman athletes doing Super League and such, or very short races, obviously the swim is super important in short distance. So that's, you know, some Ironman athletes are at a disadvantage in these multi-circuit kind of races in that it depends on their background. But I think in general, it really depends on the athletes and what they're interested in. You know, we have some athletes that are quite motivated to do long distance, and many that are quite happy to stay in the format of racing more often. And you know, I think it really depends on how the athletes see their career. And, you know, we see some athletes move to long distance kind of near the end of their Olympic career. And we won't necessarily see their best, I guess, potential, you know, for the point of debate or argument. You know, what can Alistair Brownlee do over Kona? Well, I guess we'll find out soon. It'll be interesting. But, you know, you might argue his peak over Olympic distances some years ago. And what will that mean for his iron distance performance? You know, would it be as good as it would be if he changed in 2013? You would have to assume probably not as good as what his full potential is, but I guess that's like anything, you know, you have to be motivated to do whatever the, you know, your goals are. And if at the time, you're not willing to change or not interested in changing, then, you know, it becomes a kind of an academic debate. Well, what could athletes do if they changed earlier? And, I guess, you know, these discussions have been going on forever and they will continue going on. And there'll always be some athletes that will change at the end of the Olympic cycle. And maybe some athletes that I think like Alistair or like some others that don't want to travel as much and prefer to stay at home. And certainly in long distance racing, you perhaps don't have to travel quite as much and do as many ocean hopping trips as you do in Olympic racing. And certainly that can become quite fatiguing over time, and the desire to do that can drop down. So, yeah, I mean, the 70.3 is a good middle ground on that requires sort of less specificity. But again, it's the World Series and the Olympic path has a grip on a lot of athletes, and it's, you know, the Olympic dream and you know, the incentives in terms of federation support and funding, and some athletes are supported by their country's military or police, or, you know, there's a lot of different elements to the Olympic pathway that don't exist in long course that will keep athletes racing there. And I suppose then the other thing is just there are some body types that are just not going to be as suitable for an ultra distance race. You know, I mean, I suppose in ITU racing, we have a mix. You know, we have some athletes that are more like climbers, if you want to think about the cycling model, and some are more, not exactly like sprinters, but bigger or heavier. And those athletes may be more adaptable to going over a longer distance than the smaller, smaller type athletes. And a lot of that is due to the kind of courses we have. If you think the biggest, most important race, Kona, more or less flatter and certainly not a lot of climbing and quite windy and really is going to emphasize athletes that have ability to push a lot of absolute watts and able to get quite aero, and that tends to favor slightly bigger athletes than climber types, if you like. And so some athletes just not going to be able to make that transition. And, you know, and again, thinking about just coming full circle on the motivation and the desire, at what point in their career might they want to change? And that's just different for everyone.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's a really good way of looking at it. But I guess, you know, conversely, just to play devil's advocate, because we see so many ITU athletes potentially switch up to the Ironman distance, but and they do so successfully for the most part. Again, it's very dependent on each athlete, but we hardly ever see many Ironman athletes drop down in the ITU. As you just mentioned, swim is a huge component in that as well. But is it overall, is it just not the same resilience to build that strength and speed after spending so many years at, say, going at a distance as it would be for, you know, these speedy athletes going up and just increasing their distance? So for ITU to go up to Ironman?
I guess I think of it in terms of specialization, and I guess if you're a long distance athlete, you know, most are thinking doing the full distance, doing Ironman, and then therefore focused on Kona. And that's just such a specialized event. And the demands of preparation are so specific to that, that it just, that just doesn't translate very well to racing very short distances. You wouldn't do the kind of preparation that would allow you to have a relative, even to the individual, good performance. I mean, we saw you know, Patrick Lange race, a Bundesliga recently, you know, when he was in the, I want to say the 30s, the 30 something place. And these races are not super competitive. I think it was also part of the German championships. You know, and obviously there's, you know, the Kona record holder. I mean, I'm sure he did no specific preparation for that event and, you know, probably wasn't tapered, et cetera, but, you know, just doesn't translate into that. And again, as you said before, you know, if you don't have a swimming background, then you're really going to suffer in any kind of draft legal race. And what we've seen over time in ITU racing is the demands of the swim have just ever increased, and it's more and more compact in the front. And you know, you really need to be able to swim to play a role in that. So I think it's in terms of dropping down, it's just so specialized. I mean, there are a few 70.3 specialists, I suppose. However, there's so much pressure on even those athletes to race Kona to go the full distance from sponsors and community, et cetera, that there are fewer of those kind of athletes who might be able to drop down. But it depends on the background and a lot of it, you know, just what kind of preparation they're doing. And I think in general, you know, like I say, a lot of the best Super League or mixed relay, you know, 20-minute racers are often the best over 2 hours, and athletes who have, I suppose, the potential to be the best over 2 hours have the potential to be the best also over longer distances. But, you know, again, it comes into, can their bodies manage it? Can they focus on training long enough to see the potential? And then the other part that we didn't talk about yet is the ability to process fuel over long distances, especially in very difficult environmental conditions. Like Kona is also a very specific skill that has to be trained, and there's a talent with that as well. And so, you know, I think we've always seen athletes that have a super talent over long distance who just don't have any of the profile to be relatively anywhere near that level over short distance. You know, I think of from a Canadian reference, Laurie Beaudin back in the day, you know, she wasn't terribly fast over anything short, but she could be absolutely world-class in Kona and over the iron distance. So Peter Reed, it was not bad over Olympic distance. You know, this was the pre-drafting days. He could hold his own, but again, really out exceptional over the full distance. So I think there's a specific ability, a specific talent, and like everything in sport, in the sense of the specialization of your focus, and it just makes it perhaps less transferable down than up. But that said, I mean, you don't see short distance athletes or ITU athletes just jumping in an Ironman. The preparation has to be respected. And we see, you know, with what Alistair's doing now, focusing on that Kona preparation and you know, and it's something that some will take quicker to, and some will take several years to figure it out and reach the point where they can be successful and reach their whatever their potential is.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting to hear. It's always cool to see, because it's the same sport, but just the distances separate so many different athletes, because you have such strong, you know, fast Olympic athletes, and you have conversely on the other end that some might not even be able to do the Ironman, and conversely the Ironman athletes wouldn't be able to do what the Olympic athletes are doing. So it's very fascinating. It's all one sport, but we have two different specializations on each end of the spectrum. So that's always amazing to me to kind of hear, you know, from a coaching perspective, how it all plays out for each individual. So that's very fascinating. And I mean, I guess before we move off the topic here, what are your thoughts leading into Tokyo next year? I mean, do we have certain athletes to be paying attention to? I mean, I'm thinking about your JFT squad, and we look at things like the Tokyo test event. How important were those type of races when it comes to getting an idea of how it's going to pan out in Tokyo? What's that sort of all mean to you?
Yeah, the test event was interesting this year, and you know, I suppose first it's worth saying that the test event is for the LOC. It's for the organizers, although many federations and countries, of course, adopt it as a selection event. And it's the most specific one you can get, which is obvious. But on the men's side this year, we had the first four in the rankings that that opted not to race, and that was due to the pull of the series and the fact that Lausanne was the grand final was only 2 weeks after the test event. And in the fight for the world title, then a number of those athletes elected not to race. So Mario, Vince, Javi Gomez, and Fernando Alartha, so the three Spanish and the French, decided not to race. And we saw that, you know, they were amongst the top in Lausanne, so I think it was probably the right decision for them. And when I look at that, you know, as a personal coach, and I think, you know, certainly weighed, you know, what do you gain from going versus not going? And I honestly didn't feel it would be a disadvantage to not go. And you might argue it's actually an advantage for them because they, whatever they were going to do or not do remains to be only speculated about. And in fact, athletes like that change the race when they're in the race. So, but from the point of view of looking at the course and understanding what kind of race it might be, the test event is not always the same as the Olympic Games. In fact, I think the stats say 25% over time. We don't have that many numbers because we've only had a game since 2000, but 25% of the winners of the test event have gone on to win the Olympic Games. So it would probably go a bit deeper if you go on the podium. You know, how many of the podium athletes at the test event will be the podium athletes at the Olympic Games? Might go a bit deeper than that. But it depends where it fits in the season. And again, there are vast differences in the importance to different athletes. If you're number one athlete in the world, then qualification and therefore full focus on the test event may not be a priority in the same way as somebody that is going for their focus, their entire season focus on that race. So, and it really also depends on the other parts of the season, you know, how much focus in terms of preparation and training do the athletes take before that event? And that makes a big difference, you know, whether they how much traveling are they doing in the 2 or 3 months before, how many different races are they doing in the 2 or 3 months before. And, you know, so, you know, you can certainly read something into it, but I wouldn't necessarily assume that, you know, that the men's race will be one massive pack in 2020. I'm not sure. That's more or less what it was this year. And the women's was quite spread out, which is a theme probably from the last couple of years, but then that's not necessarily going to be the same. I would assume that next year is probably going to be slightly more compacted than it was this year, where there was vast time differences between the various packs. So, you know, again, it's not the same importance to everyone, and certainly, you know, looking at how the events was how they went, we saw the challenges with the environmental conditions. The water temperature is quite warm at over 30 Celsius, and then though the air conditions weren't too bad, but in totality, the decision was made to shorten the women's run, which I don't think will happen next year. And then actually the men's race, it wasn't a particularly hot day for Tokyo. So it could be several degrees Celsius hotter, and that will make a big impact on the results as well. So certainly everyone's looking at that. And certainly from our group, we're looking at that. In general, you could say that, you know, if you go down the rankings, that, you know, the favorites will be more or less the athletes down the rankings. I mean, that's more typical. It's probably more of an exception for somebody that, you know, that's, you know, ranked 20 something in the world is probably not going to be one of the medalists, but somebody in the top 10 certainly has a chance. And you know, athletes that have been medalists before are ones you'd probably bet on to be again. And athletes that have won before are certainly athletes that you'd bet on again. And, you know, we haven't really had sort of dominant athletes who win every race. I mean, obviously, Katie Sever has won a bunch of races this year, but you know, that's an ever-evolving situation. Before her, Flora Duffy had won a bunch of races, and before her, Gwen Jorgensen had won a bunch of races in a row. And so, you know, it's an ever-growing challenge both to, I suppose, continue for some of these athletes, continue to win, continue to be successful is not easy. And if anything, you know, it's the old adage about it's harder to win your first one than to keep winning. My experience is very true. And so that's the challenge for some of those athletes in the next year. But I think the ones that can produce near their best performance, with all the extra factors of the Olympics, the extra focus and energy it takes, the external and internal pressure the athletes put on themselves, the ones that can reproduce a performance they've done before but near their best in that day have the best chance of being medalists, and as opposed to doing something that they've never done before happening in the Olympic Games doesn't happen quite as often. And I suppose in sports that are more time measured, again, we often see the Olympic Games isn't necessarily the fastest race of the year, but the ones that can do what they've done before under those special conditions. So, but the factor that everyone's thinking about and talking about is the heat and the hot conditions. And we just haven't had that many races in the last 10 years that have been particularly hot. And so it's a factor that people are thinking about, and how do they prepare for that? And, from that point of view, the test event was a medium sort of test. It wasn't particularly extreme, but we saw it still had an impact. So that's going to be a factor that people think about to next year.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's really incredible to hear. It's great to hear those specifics and to hear that insight from you, and to see, what's expected and what's potentially to come. And those are a lot of great factors that you factored in there. So I think that's a really great way to open up what's ahead. So that's very cool. And I mean, switching up here a little bit, talking more about training specifics, I guess. Now, I know we've talked highly on ITU side, but also a little bit of a background that, of course, you've had a ton of experience training Ironman athletes. Specifically Helly Fredrickson is one that comes to mind. I mean, so this question, I guess, specific to age group triathletes who might be doing things like the longer distance, like the half Ironmans or the Ironmans, when it comes to training in heart rate zones. Now, we look back at like Mark Allen did way back in the Iron War days. Is that something that, I'd like to hear your opinion on, I guess, is that something that should be done to help build that aerobic foundation for age groupers? And then also to incorporate some of that high intensity training just to keep that top end speed? Or what's your sort of thoughts on them to build that aerobic foundation to compete in those long distances?
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of keeping things simple. And I know a lot of athletes are really motivated by technology and gadgets, and these kind of things can help people get out the door or get moving. However, I think in general, keeping things simple and if anything, if somebody is progressing in the sport, I think use these kind of tools to tune your own perception of exertion of energy is where the real value is. And I think there's a downside of over monitoring and over measuring. It perhaps can take some of the joy out of the process, but also we are not robots. We're our responses, physiological responses, are within ranges and vary day to day based on a whole number of factors. And so I think in terms of monitoring and, I think keeping it simple and focusing perhaps more on holistic measures such as frequency and just general duration is a good starting point. And, if there's anything we can say, about intensity, is that most athletes do or try to do too much intensity relative to their fitness level and relative to their overall capacity to recover from that intensity. So I think, it's something I come across all the time is just athletes that want to, go at race pace or faster all the time. And small doses of that are fine and can be effective, but I think an over focus on intensity is not the healthiest and perhaps not sustainable for a lot of athletes. So with our athletes, we just focus a lot on feel and perceived exertion and what's repeatable over time, and we try to really tune the athlete's mind into the effort level of sessions. And we can start with making sure that the easy stuff is easy enough. And in often case, it's better not to be monitored. I think it can be a game of if you're always looking at your GPS watch of how fast you're doing your easy runs and not the healthiest all the time to be doing that. If they're creeping up to be faster, or if you connect your ego to how fast you're running all the time, can be not the best over the longer term. But you know, that's where I go with this is trying to keep it as simple as possible and try to find joy in the process of just, I mean, endurance sport, Ironman, long distance it's a simple process. It's not complicated. It doesn't need to be complicated. And we should remember that and try to keep it that way. In terms of, you know, you need to train yourself for the distance that your goals are, and that's the starting point. You know, can you do the distance? And well, let's break that down into frequency over days. And just because you might be more time limited as an age grouper, you've got a job, you have to fit training in the morning, in the evening, or at lunchtime, doesn't mean that all those sessions have to be in intensive. And you know, and I think the principle or the paradigm that's been more popular recently is this concept of polarized training. You know, this 80-20 concept. There's a lot of different ways to think about it, but you know, it originates from the idea that, you know, 80% of your sessions should be easy sessions, or should be basic endurance sessions, or easier, and 20% could be race pace or harder, or, you know, that can mean different things to different athletes, but hard sessions. And not necessarily by time, it's more like 90-10. These are just general concepts, but if you think about it in that way, say 8 out of 10 sessions can be easy, and over time that those layers of fitness build on each other, and you can do more with that. And I think if there's anything I say, is that concept of self-discipline and patience is how we build an endurance athlete over time. And I think you can't really rush that process. You can't shortcut it by doing more intensity sooner. Just because we can measure everything, you know, with power meters and GPS and pace, and doesn't mean that, you know, that has to be the focus. I think that, again, there's a point of thinking holistically and being in tune with your body and learning your response over time has a ton of value. And I think for athletes that are going to have a long history in triathlon and endurance sport, I think that kind of approach is more likely to have a longevity to it.
Yeah, no, honestly, I'm really glad to hear that. That's a really awesome insight. I think that could resonate with a lot of listeners, because I think, as you mentioned and identified there, that overtraining is a big problem for age groupers. And it's not so much like they're overtraining because a lot of them are time-starved athletes, but it's a matter of training too high intensities too long, because maybe we're time-starved as age groupers. So I think letting people hear that's very important to hear. It's just a matter of keeping things easy when they should be. I think that's a huge thing that people really need to focus on. So I'm glad you touched base on that and expand on that, because I think that will help a lot of people. So I think that's good to hear. So, you know, I think that's pretty much a great spot to end things off, man. Can't thank you enough for coming on here. We appreciate that. That was a lot of really awesome insight, and a lot of insight heading into Tokyo as well. That's all very cool. And I mean, before we sign off here, I just want to let listeners know that you also have a podcast as well. Can you sort of let the listeners know, you know, I guess where they can find that podcast, and also where they can get some more information on you and social media, things like your JFT squad and your coaching and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, I haven't done a ton of podcast episodes in the last 2 years, but I'm going to do a few more in the sort of off season now. That just can be on my personal website. You can find all of that, joelfilial.com. I use Instagram a fair amount. Again, the handle is my name, Joel Filial. Twitter, not as much Twitter these days, but in between Instagram and my personal website, as I said, I intend to do a few more podcasts. I have a number of speaking engagements coming up this autumn for my work with the Italian Federation and a few other things. So I'm going to use those opportunities where I have to put some focus and attention into preparing my thoughts on a few different topics to put those into podcast episodes. The podcast is called Real Coaching. Probably if you search that in my name, you'll find it. yeah, and depending when this comes out, hopefully there'll be a new episode.
Perfect, man. Awesome. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I know. I can imagine you've been busy, to say the least. I think that's an understatement of being busy. So last a while. So no, I can imagine that's probably why it's been on the back burner, per se. So no, that's cool. We're looking forward to hearing that, because as everyone heard in this episode here, that we could listen to you forever on this, some amazing insight on triathlon. So that was very cool. And thanks so much again for coming on, man. It's been a wonderful podcast. I'm sure it will resonate with a ton of listeners, and we'll be sure to keep in touch, man. All the best.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Enjoyed the chat.
Perfect. Thanks, man. Cheers. Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as it has helped me. Now, Joel Filio has done so much for the triathlon community and has been a part of so many legacies and stories over the years, and I can't wait to see what's ahead for his athletes come Tokyo 2020. And I can't thank Joel enough for coming on the show. With all things considering, he's a very busy guy. So thanks again, Joel. We appreciate that. And lastly, guys, if you want to hear more podcasts like these, then go ahead and hit that subscribe button. And you can follow me on Instagram at pacing.and.racing. And you can check us out on YouTube by searching Pacing and Racing. And lastly, if you did like this episode, please take 2 minutes to leave a kind review on the podcast channel, as this helps us get heard by more listeners through the podcast platform algorithms. Anyway, thanks, guys. We'll talk to you next time.